Well, good morning. Looks like we have some students with us today. My notes say the students from Union Grove High School are here. If they are here with their teachers and advisors, would you please stand? Very good. Well, thanks for coming to see us on this sunny day. You may be seated. I'd like to introduce the court to the students. The council is familiar with the court, but I will introduce them to the students. On my far right, Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. And next to me, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left, Justice Michael Gableman. And the far left, Justice Daniel Kelly. So with those introductions, before I go on further, if you students, the students can stay after this argument, Justice Michael Gableman will come out and talk with you a little bit about procedures in the court, not the substance of the argument that we're going to be hearing shortly, but tell you a little bit more about how our court fits within the court systems and a number of other things. So if you're here and you can stay, he will spend a bit of time with you on that. So with those preliminaries, I will call our second case of the day, State versus Lemberger. Are you ready to proceed? Please do.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Robert Eddington. I represent the defendant appellant petitioner Gary Lemberger in this case. Your Honors, the central question in this appeal is whether Gary Lemberger's trial counsel was ineffective for failing to object when the prosecutor repeatedly commented on Lemberger's refusal to consent to a warrantless search in the form of a breath test following his arrest for drunk driving. Your Honor's trial counsel was ineffective in this case for three reasons. First, a person has a constitutional right to refuse to consent to a search in the form of a breath test where there is no warrant and no warrant exception that's applicable. Second, for constitutional purposes, consent to a breath test must be actual and voluntary and not implied by virtue of the state's implied consent statute. And finally, where that constitutional right exists, a prosecutor's comment on refusal to consent to a warrantless test impermissibly burdened Lemberger's constitutional rights. It is settled that the taking of a breath sample constitutes a search under both the U.S. and the Wisconsin constitutions. Because a breath test is a search, it must be reasonable in order to be constitutional. And to be reasonable, it must be supported either by a warrant or by an applicable warrant exception. Courts in Wisconsin and other jurisdictions have recognized that a person has a constitutional right to decline to consent to a warrantless search. That was squarely the holding of the Court of Appeals 2010 decision in State versus Banks, and has also been recognized in numerous federal courts that we cite in our briefs.
What about Birchfield that says he can have a breathalyzer, is okay without a warrant because it's incident to an arrest? Is this incident to an arrest, or don't you think I stated Birchfield right?
Well, Your Honors, we don't contend that Birchfield controls the outcome of this case for two reasons. The first reason is that, for the reasons that we articulate in our brief, we contend that Section 1, or Article 1, Section 11 of the state constitution should decline to extend the Birchfield rule on search incident to lawful arrest in this case. And the second reason is that this is a case that arises in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel. And because it arises in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel, the appropriate focus is what trial counsel's actions and decisions were at the time of trial, his performance at the time of trial, and the resulting prejudice to the trial that happened in that case.
Birchfield is after trial.
That's correct, Your Honor. Now, after we filed...
Counsel, yes. Is it your position that there is something about Birchfield that violates a Wisconsin constitutional provision?
Not that violates, Your Honor, but we contend that there are some compelling policy reasons that would justify recognizing a broader protection, in other words, not extending the search incident to lawful arrest rule.
Would any of those reasons be found in the text of the Wisconsin Constitution?
Well, the text of the Constitution speaks primarily to the issue of reasonableness. And one of the compelling reasons that we articulate in our brief is that, and we think it's particularly applicable here, is that the search incident to lawful arrest exception is an exception that applies by its terms after an arrest has been effectuated. Because this is an implied consent case and a case that is happening as part of the implied consent framework, this Court has already stated that one of the compelling reasons that underlie the implied consent statute is to be able to identify who drunk drivers are and to remove them from the highways. And so we would contend that search incident to arrest does not further that goal, because once an arrest has happened, the drunk driver has been identified and he's been removed from the highway.
Okay. He was arrested, though, correct?
That's correct.
And he refused the breath test after the arrest?
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay.
So are you asking us to scale back the search incident to arrest exception to the warrant requirement?
No, Your Honor. What our position is in this case is that the search incident to lawful arrest doctrine is one that developed to authorize at the time of arrest a search of the suspect's person and the wingspan, the areas into which a person could reach to conceal or destroy evidence. In the Birchfield decision, the Supreme Court drew a distinction between blood tests, which it concluded could not be conducted as a search incident to lawful arrest, and breath tests, which the Supreme Court concluded for Fourth Amendment purposes it could. The position that we're taking in this case, Your Honor, is that that distinction between blood tests and breath tests the Supreme Court drew in Birchfield not be applied in this case as a matter of the Wisconsin Constitution.
And the reason you have for asking us not to make that distinction, is that based on the circumstances here, or has there been a wrinkle in Wisconsin law and practice that says that should not apply here?
Well, there are really three reasons. The first reason is the one that we just identified, which is that the search incident to lawful arrest exception would naturally apply after arrest and after a person's been removed from the road. That's the first reason. The second and third reasons relate to the development of search and seizure law in Wisconsin through this court's decision, for example, in State versus Kennedy, which relied on Missouri versus McNeely's recognition of the fact that there have been many advances in technology that mean that in 2017. It's much more practical and much easier to obtain a warrant. And on the facts of this case, we would contend that that is a very applicable and very pertinent observation. As we noted a moment ago, after Lemberger was arrested, he was placed in a squad car. He was taken back to the police station. He was placed under observation for a full 20 minutes. At trial, the arresting officer, Officer Naylor, testified that there are procedures available to obtain a warrant to do a search, and when he was asked if he did that, and he said he just didn't do it in this case. So,
he probably didn't do it in this case, because we've said that you can do a search incident to an arrest, and that's a categorical exception to the warrant requirement, right?
It is a categorical exception. That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, so we don't need, in those kinds of analyses, we don't need to worry about would it be easy to get a warrant? Should you have tried to get a warrant? Did the circumstances dictate against that? We don't have to worry about any of that, right? We can just say arrest, we can do search.
That's right, although at the time that this case is proceeding up to this court, to my knowledge, has not applied that rule categorically in drunk driving cases. That was a development that happened after the petition was filed in this case because of the Birchfield rule.
Is that necessarily the case? And the reason I ask is because I believe there was a case back in 1980 in which a court of appeals held that a breathalyzer test was a search, right?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And cases subsequent to that have said you have no constitutional right to deny a breathalyzer test, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so don't those two things together kind of equal Birchfield for this purpose?
We would say no, Your Honor. And the reason for that is, again, looking at what the state of the law was at the time that these various things were happening. So the earlier decisions that we reference in our brief, the State versus Albright, State versus Bolstad, this court's State versus Bolstad and State versus Crandall decision, those three decisions rested on a premise that there was no constitutional right to refuse. In Albright and in Crandall, a breath test. In Bolstad, it was a blood test that was at issue.
It turns out we were right.
The Supreme Court agreed for Fourth Amendment purposes. That's right, Your Honor. The issue, though, at that point in time, though, and again going back to our point about ineffective assistance of counsel and what trial counsel's obligation was in November of 2014 when the trial took place, in the 1980s when those earlier decisions were made, the primary decision was Schmerber versus California, the Supreme Court case from about 1966, that held that a warrantless blood test was constitutionally permitted. And Schmerber had found exigent circumstances in that case. As the law developed after Schmerber, many courts, including this court in the 1993 State versus Bowling decision, applied a categorical warrant exception based on exigent circumstances. That was the state of the law at the time of the 1986, earlier decisions from this court. So at that point in time, it's our position that there was an applicable warrant exception, which would make it somewhat unsurprising that the court would conclude that there was no right to refuse at that point. That had changed, though, by the time of Lemberger's trial in this case. By the time of November 2014, there were three things that were important. First, there was no warrant. That's not in dispute. The second thing is that there was no categorical exception that applied at that point in time. The Missouri versus McNeely decision had intervened by then and abrogated the Bowling rule and held that there was no categorical exigent circumstances exception. As a matter of state law, the Court of Appeals decision in State versus Padley had been decided, and that decision concluded that the implied consent statute does not itself create its own exception to the warrant requirement. And then the third thing was the State versus Banks ruling in 2010 that held that a trial counsel has an affirmative duty to object to a prosecutor's comments when a suspect or defendant refuses to consent to a warrantless search. So those were the things that were happening as of 2014 when the trial took place. And it's based on that development of the law that is at odds with the fundamental premise in those earlier 1980s decisions from this court. The second point that I wanted to discuss with the court this morning is sort of dovetails into that question, which is the interplay of implied consent in this discussion. It's our position, for the reasons that we have already discussed and articulated, that the search incident to lawful arrest exception should not be applied categorically. The Missouri versus McNeely decision has held that there is no exigent circumstances exception that applies. And sort of the next step in the analysis is implied consent. And it's our position that obviously consent is a recognized exception to the warrant requirement, but this court and the U.S. Supreme Court have long held that for consent to be constitutionally valid, it has to be freely and voluntarily given, and that merely acquiescing to a claim of lawful authority is not constitutionally valid consent. So because the consent must be freely and voluntarily given, it's our position, Your Honors, that the implied consent that's implied under Wisconsin's implied consent statute does not itself create an exception to the warrant requirement. And in fact, that was the conclusion that the Court of Appeals reached in State versus Padley and State versus Blackmun. The implied consent statute speaks and provides that any person who drives or operates a motor vehicle on the public highways of this state is deemed to have given consent to chemical testing. And that phrase, deemed to have given consent, is what the Court of Appeals in Padley and Blackmun was examining. That is obviously stated in past tense. It's a deemed consent at the time that the motor vehicle is operated. But Padley and Blackman both recognized that the statute itself is not providing actual consent to a warrantless search.
Doesn't Padley say, in effect, that the statute shows you can revoke it? And that's the whole point of reading that.
That's correct.
Statutory language.
That's correct, Your Honor. Padley and Blackman both recognize that a driver under the implied consent statute has basically two options. There's implied consent that is deemed to have been given as a condition of operating a motor vehicle. And when requested to provide a breath sample or a blood sample or urine sample under the statute, the driver has two choices. The driver can either acknowledge that prior deemed implied consent and thereby provide actual consent, or withdraw that consent, and that's what happened in this case.
Well, we have another case pending, and I'm sorry I've forgotten its name, but in that one, the state asked us to overturn Padley. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I'm generally aware of that.
Okay, is the state doing that here?
The way I understand the state's argument, Your Honor, is that the state, obviously I don't want to put words in the state's mouth, but the way that I understand the state's argument is that they read the implied consent statute to provide blanket consent in all cases as its own exception to the warrant requirement, and we don't think that that is, first of all, consistent with Padley or Blackman, but we also don't think that that's consistent with the text of the implied consent statute itself. The state in its brief argues that there is no right to refuse chemical testing without consequences, and it uses that term without consequences. The Padley decision certainly speaks of consequences, and the implied consent statute itself speaks of consequences for withdrawal of consent. And to be clear about our argument is not that there can never be consequences that apply to a withdrawal of consent. The rule that we are arguing for in this case is that where there is that constitutional right, because there is no applicable exception and because there is no there's no actual consent, that in those cases, and there's no warrant, in those cases there is a constitutional right, and commentary on that right would then be inappropriate. I spoke a few moments ago about the Albright, Bolstad, and Crandall cases. One of the important developments in the law was the 2010 State versus Banks decision, and that brings me to the third point that I wanted to discuss this morning.
The Banks decision, the DNA?
That's correct, Your Honor. And in Banks, Banks was a case where a person was requested to consent to a warrantless DNA sample, and that individual declined to give consent. At trial, the trial counsel failed to object when evidence of that refusal went into the record and when the prosecutor commented on that evidence. The rationale that the Banks court used, we think, is particularly helpful and appropriate here, which is that where that privilege exists to decline to consent, that the value of that privilege would be largely destroyed if persons could be penalized for relying on them. The state argues that Banks is not applicable because it does not arise in the context of implied consent, but it's our position, Your Honors, that distinction does not matter. The point from Banks and the U.S. Supreme Court case that Banks is based on, Griffin versus California and Doyle, is that where there's a constitutional right, it's improper for that right to be discredited by adverse commentary by the prosecutor. So it's our position that because that right, we're arguing, is of constitutional dimension, then whether the police is asking for consent to provide a DNA sample or whether the police is standing at a suspect's front door and asking for permission to search, that there is a constitutional right to decline that search. And when that happens, there should be no basis for comment on that.
But you would agree that if we applied Birchfield, that would not recognize a constitutional right to refuse when you have an incident to arrest?
Well, again, we come back to yes and no. So we have our position is sort of a twofold position there. First, we are arguing that the state constitution should go beyond what Birchfield holds. But if the court does not agree with that and contends that the state constitution is coextensive with Birchfield, then we come back to our ineffective assistance of counsel lens, which is why it's important to look at the state of the law that existed at the time of trial and what was happening at the time of trial.
Implicit in your argument that we should extend the protections under the state constitution is an acknowledgement that if we embraced and applied Birchfield, you wouldn't prevail on the issue. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. We're saying that we look at, again, it's a two-pronged response to that. For the purposes of the Fourth Amendment, Birchfield resolved that question in a way that we would not have preferred it to resolve that question, and we acknowledge that in our brief. So the first part of the answer to that question is, yes, we're looking to the state constitution to go beyond what Birchfield has said. And part of that is because Birchfield drew a distinction, which we contend is somewhat arbitrary, between blood tests and breath tests. Going back as far as the Supreme Court's 1989 decision in Skinner, the court recognized that breath tests and blood tests both implicate similar privacy concerns. We contend that that's correct, and that's been the basis of the development of the law in Wisconsin ever since the Skinner decision was decided. So, for the purpose and in the interest of consistency, we think that it is somewhat arbitrary to draw that line between blood tests and breath tests. We also acknowledge that under the Wisconsin Constitution, part of the discussion, part of the development of that law has been the recognition that the technology has gotten better, which allows warrants to be obtained more easily, more efficiently, and without adversely affecting the any particular investigation. And we think that's borne out by what the record evidence shows
here. It just interferes with the sleep of some judges, I think that's
perhaps that's true, Your Honor. Perhaps that's true. But again, going back to the McNeely case as adopted by this court in Kennedy, that was one of the sort of policy rationales that underpinned that decision, is that where there is an opportunity to obtain a warrant without adversely impacting an investigation, that should be done. And that goes to the long-standing recognition as a matter of policy of the importance of warrants and why warrants should be obtained. And sort of the final point on the question about the Wisconsin Constitution, and we refer to some of this statutory language in our reply brief, but there is language throughout the implied consent statute that refers to the obligation that a police officer has to request a sample when he suspects that a person is driving under the influence, and we would contend that if there is always an exception that applies in every case that would authorize this test, then there's really no, it sort of renders that statutory language superfluous because there's no real reason to request because permission would be largely irrelevant. So for those reasons, it's our position that at the time of the trial, there was no warrant that justified the search. There was no applicable exception. That was, again, pre-Birchfield, and even applying Birchfield, we feel that should not apply. There were no exigent circumstances under McNeely, and consent could not be implied through the implied consent laws. So it's on that basis that we argue that the trial counsel, Lemberger's trial counsel, was ineffective for not objecting to the evidence, for not objecting to the prosecutor's comments of the evidence of refusal. So for that reason, we would respectfully request that the court reverse the Court of Appeals.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General Michael Sanders representing the State. This Court should affirm the decisions of the Trial Court and Court of Appeals because, as the Trial Court recognized, Lemberger's claim is wholly unsupported by Wisconsin law and contrary to controlling legal authority. The problem isn't just that his claim fails on those grounds. It's that the claim is really that his trial counsel was constitutionally required to make a claim which is wholly unsupported by the law and contrary to what this Court has said.
Sometimes when I make a statement like that, I then finish it with strong words to follow. I mean, you seem rather assertive in that position.
I think it's really clear. And the trial court said that, and the Court of Appeals said the same thing. There are cases from the 80s, from this court, two from this court, one from the Court of Appeals, Albright, Volstead, and Crandall, that say that the prosecutor can do exactly what the prosecutor did here. Those cases have not been overruled, and the issue three that Lemberger raises is that this court should now overrule them, which I think is kind of means that they haven't been overruled, and if those cases haven't been overruled, the trial court had to follow them, and his counsel could not have been ineffective for asking the trial court to sustain an objection that is contrary to those cases.
Well, that all makes sense, and I agree with what
good.
You said. It's not that good.
I think it's pretty good.
You're good, but not great, I guess.
Well, you so always nice. Have to wait for the but. There, 1980s, they're at least 20 years old, maybe closer to 30
sure.
years old. There's been a lot of alcohol out of the bars and onto the highways since then, mm-hmm. and a lot of cases involving alcohol, search, seizure, exigent circumstances, warrant, mm-hmm. quick getty warrants.
Certainly.
I mean, you've got a whole new body of law, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you got U.S. Supreme Court cases.
Mm-hmm.
And you got McNeely, which has been subject to a lot of debate in the trial courts across the country and in the Supreme Courts. So let's just take a hypothetical. So you got these 30 plus or minus years of change in the law, and I think you'll concede there have been changes, whether they affect this or not. And you got the trial court faced with the three cases that say what you said they said, mm-hmm. namely the prosecutor can comment, and there can even be a jury instruction, right? There still is a jury instruction.
Oh, yes, yes.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, which was given, which is favorable to the state here, and that's fine. So suppose the trial court thinks, though, that they're not very good anymore in light of McNeely, in light of the fact you can get telephonic warrants very quickly. Can the trial court say, hey, these cases are no longer constitutional, federal constitution, and therefore we're not going to follow them? Or do they have to follow it? Maybe clear unconstitutional cases.
Well, the court could do that. It would, I guess, be a trial court who would find the statute to be unconstitutional. But this is clearly not unconstitutional. And that isn't raised. And still, it has to be a question, as the defendant has said, of whether his counsel was constitutionally required to make an argument that the trial court isn't really going to follow because it has to follow what this court said. What the court, I guess, could do if it was raised as a constitutional thing, he could say it's unconstitutional, but would still have to deal with this court's cases. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what the court would do, but I don't think it's required of a defense attorney to make an argument that the trial court is just going to say no to. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In Maloney in 2005, this court said that trial counsel is not required to make an argument that is where he's trying to deal with unsettled law. Here it's not that. It is completely settled. It's just on the opposite side. So it would be requiring counsel to make a claim which just can't win. And there's no, if the court isn't going to really change how the ineffective assistance law works, there's really no way to get there because this claim fails. You spoke of the developments since the 80s, but during that time, there's not a court anywhere that has said that what the prosecutor did here is wrong or is unconstitutional. There's nothing in McNeely, there's nothing in Birchfield, there's nothing in any of this court's cases that say that the prosecutor couldn't do exactly what he did here.
Is that the general rule across the country that the prosecutor can comment on a refusal for either breathalyzer or blood test?
As far as I know, no state has said you can't do it. And the Supreme Court said in Neville in 1983 that it's fine. Mm-hmm. And that case has not been overruled. And in McNeely and in Birchfield, the court cited that for that proposition in McNeely, and it cited it and said it's fine. It said, if I have got the quote, that in that case, the court had held that the use of such an adverse inference does not violate the Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. That's McNeely at 1566. And it didn't say anything in Birchfield that is against that. Instead, it talked about how it had cited that case in McNeely, and it said that nothing that it said in Birchfield should cast any doubt on implied consent laws and their constitutionality, and it specifically referred to the fact that there are both civil or criminal penalties as well as evidentiary consequences, which is that you can put in the evidence of refusal and the prosecutor can talk to the jury about it.
And that was in Birchfield.
Yes.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
My cite to it is on 2185.
I understand that. And of course, do you think we can look at Birchfield since it was after the trial?
Yes, because it's what the U.S. Constitution says. And this court has said that our state constitution in this way works in the same way. And the two cases that Leinberger cites as changing the law somehow, the two cases from the Court of Appeals, Banks, State v. Banks and State v. Padley, both say that the constitutions work in exactly the same way. So even if the Court of Appeals in those cases somehow tried to say that what this court had said in Bolstead and Crandall was wrong, it didn't get there because it said that the constitutions work the same way, and it's clearly fine under the U.S. Constitution.
Are you asking us to overturn Padley?
It doesn't have to be overturned, but it should be limited and fixed. There are some things in Padley which I don't think are right. That's in part what the state was trying to do with in House, mm-hmm. a case which it heard earlier.
Right.
And there are two more cases coming up this, well, I don't know if they'll be this term. They're in briefing right now.
They're in briefing.
Yeah.
We accepted petitions. For
yes.
Okay.
State v. Blackman, as well as Brar, two more cases. I don't know if they'll be heard this term or not. At least in Blackman, I expect that's going to be a huge issue. How? Because in Blackman, the court relied heavily on Padley, and there are problems with Padley. So I don't know if we're asking it to be overturned. We liked how the court decided the case in terms of the outcome, just not how it got there.
That you're talking about Blackmun. Which one do you like the outcome, even though you don't like
We like the outcome in both, and we didn't like how the court got there in either.
That's an easy response. So you like the destination, but not the journey.
Yes. Thank you.
All right.
That's a much,
The court
yes.
The Court of Appeals decision here is a one-judge decision,
yes.
And it's a rather brief decision.
Mm-hmm.
If you would ask us to write a decision where you prevail, and let me assure you that's a big ask.
That's fair.
How would the Court of Appeals opinion be improved, if at all, by amplification?
Well, I think the easy way for the court to write an opinion is to say that the law has been settled since the 1980s. The more recent cases haven't changed anything, and the defendant's trial counsel could not have been ineffective for not making a claim which is contrary to what this court has said. If it wants to get into the constitutional part of it, then the opinion gets a lot longer and more complicated. It can, and what we would say is the same as we've said from the start, which is that there is no constitutional right to refuse a test. Whether it's a blood test, a breath test, any test, there's no constitutional right, there is no statutory right. There is a statutory opportunity in the implied consent law that you have if you are conscious and capable of withdrawing consent, but it's neither a constitutional right nor a statutory right. So as to how to improve the Court of Appeals opinion, I don't know. It kind of depends on how far the court wants to go. It could be very simple and say the court's not going to hold that trial counsel is constitutionally required to make an argument that is contrary to the law, which I think is what the Court of Appeals said.
Well, the Court of Appeals said, in effect, that this is all forfeited.
It's all what?
Forfeited. The argument is, although in paragraph 10.
Yes.
Pardon me?
Yes.
That's the paragraph you're going to refer us to?
Well, the court said that up until paragraphs 10 and 11.
Okay.
And then said, yes, he didn't raise this properly, but even if he did, it doesn't matter because the law is clear.
That's right.
And so that would make for a short opinion. Here it was essentially, one page.
Well, that's because he's relying on the same cases you did, right?
Mm-hmm. Which have not been overruled.
Ballstead, Crandall, and then throws in Cook v. Cook that he can't overturn.
Right. Well, it's those three cases, and there is a fourth case which said the same thing. This court in 1999 in Rader said the same thing. And they've all relied on the U.S. Supreme Court case in Neville from 1983, which also has not been overruled.
Your Rider case is the one that's referred to in the letter of February 10th. Okay.
Yes.
Got it. You don't seem to care about interpreting the Wisconsin Constitution. You don't think that there's much chance the court's going to do that? Is that why you're not addressing it?
I guess I hadn't had a question about it, so I hadn't addressed it. I don't think there's any reason to. The only two cases that Weinberger cites to ask the court to interpret it in a way that's not the same as the U.S. Constitution, State v. Banks and State v. Padley, in both of those cases, the Court of Appeals said our Constitution's working exactly the same way. So I don't think anyone's thought that there's any reason to interpret our Constitution in any way differently than under the U.S. Constitution. And I don't think there's any reason to do so. I guess I should talk a little bit about the U.S. Supreme
Court. Your brief somewhere says that most of the time the court just follows the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah, Hargis in the court said that our we do it the same way as they do it for the U.S. Constitution, and unless there's some compelling reason to change it, which I don't think there is, I don't think there's any reason, much less a compelling one, then it works the same way. And as the U.S. Supreme Court has said, and to just try to clarify what I think the court said in Birchfield, it did draw a distinction between blood and breath, but it didn't draw one in a way that affects our law, because the court said a blood draw that is required under an implied consent law is fine as long as there are no criminal penalties for refusal. Since we don't have that, it has no effect on us because it said a breath test is fine whether the state is imposing a criminal penalty or a civil penalty. So our law, which only imposes a civil penalty, is fine. All that case really did is say that our law is fine. It's not unconstitutional. As long as you can't be jailed for refusal to a blood test, and we don't do that. But it said, even under those circumstances, you can still have you can still allow into court proof that the person chose not to take the test, and the prosecutor can still talk about it. So it doesn't hurt our law. It just means that our law is good and is constitutional. It's the same thing in McNeely. It didn't say anything to cast any doubt on our law in terms of implied consent.
That's a very broad reading of McNeely and Birchfield.
It may be broad, but I think it's right.
But it's yours, right?
Yes, okay. And I think it's right. I don't think there's anything in there that says anything about our law being unconstitutional or
That's
in
right.
any way in doubt.
That's
With regard
right.
to implied consent.
Yes,
That's
yes,
right.
yes, yes.
I agree that it doesn't say anything about whether the law in other circumstances is good or not good. It dealt with the fact situation and the law it had before.
I didn't hear all of that. I'm sorry.
The case law, Birchfield and mm-hmm. McNeely, dealt with the statutes it had before it
yes.
and the facts.
Yes.
And made few, if any, pronouncements as to different facts and different laws.
That's true, but the court did say that nothing in its opinion should be read to cast any doubt on implied consent laws, which work exactly like our law.
Doesn't
so it might not
it,
have.
But it,
I don't mean it said
right.
the Wisconsin implied consent law is constitutional.
That's right.
But it said you shouldn't read this in any way to as the court trying to tell us that it's not constitutional.
That's right. Just read it to cover the
right.
facts and statutes that they talked about.
Sure.
Don't draw anything else from it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I agree with that.
But that there's nothing in the Constitution that says that a law like ours is bad. And there isn't, and that's what this court has held many, many times.
Mm-hmm. Do you disagree with Banks? That's the DNA case.
No, it's just not an implied consent case, and it doesn't have anything to do with this case. And it relied on a Griffin, U.S. Supreme Court case, but in Neville v. South Dakota, the in an implied consent case, the U.S. Supreme Court said in note 10 that the rule of that prior case that the state can't talk about a exercise of a constitutional right does not apply in the implied consent law because the court said a person suspected of drunk driving has no constitutional right to refuse to take a blood alcohol test. So that's fine, but it has nothing to do with implied consent.
That's right. But you have a constitutional right not to incriminate yourself. That's the distinction
yes.
you're making. That was the Griffith case.
Right. And that's true, and we're not here to say Banks is wrong. It just has nothing to do with this law, with the implied consent law, because as the U.S. Supreme Court has said, and this court has said, there is no constitutional right to refuse a test.
Okay.
Under the implied consent law.
Is there a constitutional right to refuse a DNA test?
According to Banks, yes.
That's.
And I'm not here to say that that's wrong.
Okay.
I guess I was expecting more questions.
That's pretty eloquent.
Well, for me, you know,
it makes
you
kind
of take what you get.
It makes you nervous that the green light's still on, and
it's very strange.
Come to the end of your argument.
In the past, there have been some times when the light's been off for some time, and I guess a couple things that are not in the brief, but that in terms of the cases. There is a general constitutional right in lots of cases to withdraw consent, but even that, in a couple of recent cases, courts have said, one is an FSUP case and one is a F3rd case, the courts have said a blood alcohol test is not of constitutional origin, that implied consent laws are not of constitutional origin, but a statutory grace be bestowed by legislative bodies. And those are cases from 2015. So even the newer cases haven't led the courts to say that there's anything different here. There really isn't. I guess since the green light's on, if you'd like, I can talk about Padley.
Yeah. Or you can say thank you very much and let the opposing counsel continue.
And that the court can go to lunch.
Oh, boy. That's a tough one. Well, I'll just say extremely briefly, as much as I can. What we do not agree with in Padley is the idea that there is a difference between implied consent and actual consent, and that the consent that matters is what happens when the officer asks. That isn't the consent. As the statute says, and as this court has held countless times, the consent in an implied consent law, in the implied consent law, is the consent you give when you start the car. And that's where I think the state thinks the Court of Appeals went wrong in Padley and in Blackmun, that's the time which counts. And at that time, you have a chance to withdraw consent. You can either not drive, or you can stop the car, you can get out. But once you're stopped or you crash, it's too late. And at that point, you have no right to withdraw consent. If you are not unconscious, you may have an opportunity to withdraw consent, but it's not a right. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honors. Three very brief points. First of all, the 2010, my colleague spoke of ineffective assistance of counsel. In 2010, there was a published Court of Appeals decision that required trial counsel to object to prosecutors' comments on a refusal to consent to a test. Now, we acknowledge that is not an implied consent case, but for the reasons that we already discussed, we don't think that that is a distinction that matters in this case. Banks required that objection. And for that reason, that's part of the reason why a trial counsel was ineffective. In 2014, the U.S. Supreme Court in Hinton versus Alabama squarely held that a trial counsel's failure to research the basic law that impacts the various options that he has at trial, and this was one of the options he had at trial, that was the very definition of ineffective assistance. The second point was my opposing counsel brought up the Maloney case, which holds generally that a trial counsel doesn't have an obligation to argue an unsettled point of law. But it's our contention that because of Banks, because of the 2010 published Banks decision, there was an obligation that was not unsettled. There was an affirmative obligation for trial counsel to object. The final point that we wanted to mention was the Neville, South Dakota versus Neville case, which comes from 1983. That's been discussed a lot by my opposing counsel and in the briefs. Two points about that. First of all, the Supreme Court, in addressing the due process argument there, that due process had been violated by a prosecutor's comment and refusal, Supreme Court mentioned and noted that there was no due process violation in that case because the right at issue in that case was a statutory right and not a constitutional right. And that was because the South Dakota statute at issue contained a provision that gave a suspect a right to refuse. So it wasn't dealing with or addressing with the type of constitutional right that we're arguing for in this case. The second point is in 1983, when Neville was decided, the controlling U.S. Supreme Court case was Schmerber versus California. And in Schmerber, which was a blood test case, in Schmerber, the court had applied the exigent circumstances exception to the warrant requirement. And many courts, including this court in Bowling in 1993, interpreted that to mean that there was always an applicable exception. So on those, for those two reasons, Neville does not answer the question here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, thank you both for fine arguments. The beat goes on what is enough consent or not enough consent. The court is going to adjourn until our afternoon case, which begins at 1:30. And students, if you can stay, Justice Gableman will be out shortly to talk with you. Thank you very much.